This is the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
Presented by First Light, creating proven, versatile hunting apparel from merino base layers to technical outerwear for every hunt. First Light. Go farther, stay longer. All right, everybody, we're coming from Michigan's Upper Peninsula, the UP. And here with Sean Weaver, who has to be in pain right now to be recording a stupid podcast in the cold gray light of dawn on a duck hunt.
Right at sunrise, recording a podcast.
It should be illegal. But the way it worked out, like, Phil's here. All the way to take his engineering abilities on the road.
That's true.
Did you have fun yesterday, Phil, out duck hunting?
Oh, yeah. No, it was a blast. Especially, I mean, we'll get into it later, but seeing those boats you're using and everything, it was something I was not aware of.
You weren't aware of layout boats?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The last time we were, this is a different experience, because the last time we were on the road together to record a show, we got to go to a tiki bar.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. I was planning on going by myself. I wasn't going to subject you to that. And then, for some reason, you and Cal, Rourke Denver, your wife, all decided to join.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was embarrassing for you witness me in that sort of space.
But was it your birthday or my anniversary?
It was my wedding anniversary, and we shared a drink out of a pineapple.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's pre-COVID, people.
Yeah, that's
well,
true.
Well, no. It was the birth of COVID.
Yeah, that's it.
It was February 2020. Before shit hit the fan.
Yeah.
We're at the National Wild Turkey Federation.
There's today. No way of knowing, but us sharing that drink could have, you know, it could have spread it.
Yeah, it was the pineapple.
Yeah.
Okay, so Phil's here, joined by Sean Weaver and also Dylan Graves, Michigan native. Lake State University. Did you graduate?
I did.
Oh, alum. What'd you study?
Fisheries and Wildlife.
Oh, you did?
Yep.
Man, everybody I know that went there did that.
Well, I haven't used it yet, but I doubt it.
Well, no, you use it like like what it was meant for, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got a major in duck hunting with a minor.
You don't feel that you ever killed. Have you ever killed a duck you wouldn't have killed if you hadn't gone to Lake State and learned something?
Probably not.
Probably not. I've forked out a lot of money to kill one extra duck.
Yeah, right. I'd like to. Yeah, I want. It makes me return to a thing that Pat Durkin said, I think on this podcast, where he was talking about. Well, Pat Durkin used to be the editor of Deer and Deer Hunting magazine, and so he got to spend a lot of time with and profile a lot of like sort of the most famous big buck killers
right
on the planet, and. He gradually became disheartened because he said that somehow many of them, as polished as they are at killing deer, would be incapable of telling you what kind of tree their tree stand is in.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he wanted it to be otherwise.
Right.
You know, but it's good that you got like a Fish and Wildlife deal.
Yeah. I enjoyed it. And it brought me to this area that I'd really never explored a whole lot, and I got 4 years to drive around and look at all sorts of shit. And
so you started up here.
Yeah, I came up here in 2015 was my freshman year, and then
you did it because of the hunting potential.
The big thing for me was that when you lived on campus at our public safety, you could like check in your shotgun.
Yep.
So you could, if you lived in the dorms, you could put your gun at the public safety, and then you could go in, check it out, go hunting, and then bring it back in.
So you lived in dorms?
Yeah, my first 2 years.
Yeah. See, when I was up here, we got a waiver somehow or another.
They had like a sign off you could do that they had to approve if you wanted to live
off campus
within the first 2 years.
Yeah.
But I did the dorm life for 2 years and then moved off.
It's interesting, this place. I'm glad to hear that Lake State and the UP still sucks in hunting and fishing kids from downstate, because me and my two brothers, They both wanted to do Fish and Wildlife. So we all did community college, which we called like 13th grade, Muskegon Community College. And then they came up here. I came up and did 1 year, but I was like I wanted to be a writer by that point, mostly. So I only did one semester here and then went back downstate where you could get like a writing, whatever the hell.
Yeah.
At Grand Valley. But then we hung out here. This is our primary hangout for years.
Yeah.
Up here to fish steelhead.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You know, everything else, man. Hunting deer.
Yeah. There's all sorts of, if you just kind of get out and, you know, explore, you can find all the fishing and hunting opportunities you want.
Oh, it's amazing, man.
Oh, and it's like a 20-30 minute drive. It's not,
exactly.
You're not ranging like you find out in the West where you got to go a few hours.
Everything's four hours
yeah,
away.
Yeah.
No, that's a good spot, man. Mm-hmm. So now you're a waterfowl guide.
Yep.
But you work out in Kansas.
I died out in Kansas for Bid Kansas Outdoors. And then.
What's that place?
We're out of Hutchinson.
Do you recommend it?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's good people.
Yeah.
Would you tell me if you didn't recommend it? That'd put you in a weird spot.
Yeah, as long as Ben's not listening to the podcast. No, I last year was my first year. I really enjoyed it. It was completely different for me, coming from Michigan where you're hunting honkers and going out there and you're hunting lessers and specks and snows. And that was just completely different.
Yeah.
There was a big learning curve. And I'm sure I'll learn more this year too, but there's a lot of birds. Everybody at the business does their part. Everybody works hard and we put our clients on birds.
But that was your first year. I'm confused. So last year was your first year guiding there or first year as a guide ever?
First year guiding there, and I did a few controlled pheasant hunts here in Michigan at some ranches. But that was about it. And then obviously out there is like 4.5 months of guiding. So it's a grind. And then I come back here, and this year I have a good buddy, kind of central UP that runs bear hunts. And I went out there and I helped him run bear clients, in September. And then I ran a few honker hunts up here too.
Oh, you did?
I did.
So when you're doing the bear clients, you guys are it's like draw tags, but you're running baits in September.
Yep. So we have a point system for our bear tags here. And then we took on 20 clients and we run 35 different baits. So we stay busy.
Did you guys get big bears?
We had a lot on camera. The biggest bear we killed was 300 pounds.
Okay.
Which for Michigan, our average black bear is 125 pounds.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a good bear. But we had a lot of pictures, you know, 400 or 500 pounders. But when you get clients in the stand that have never seen a bear before, the smaller one's always going to come in first.
And they
so
think
when
they're
that,
huge.
When that 150, 175 walks in, to them, it looks like the 400 pounder and they shoot it. But
we didn't have, like when I lived in the lower peninsula, we didn't have bear hunting. There was bear hunting a little bit north of us. But we didn't have bear hunting where we live. So like bear tags weren't really on our radar.
Right.
When my brother Danny started going to school up here, he right away drew a bear tag. So we started going out and shooting carp with our bows, which isn't the best bait. But we didn't really know what we were doing.
Yeah.
And I had a big freezer I would use to freeze like muskrats and stuff during trapping season. We filled that thing up with bags of carp that we shot with our bows. And so he started a little bait station up here and right away killed and I remember he had a nice one. He killed like a 200-pound boar.
Nice.
Right away. And then my other brother, when he came up here, he got a bear tag, and he went and did like the thing where you go around and get expired groceries.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, I remember it was so funny. He came into a case of bugles. You know, it was like little bugles.
Treats. Oh, yeah.
Put them on your fingers.
You put them on your fingers. Or you get cheese. Like I remember a guy used to, when I was working for doing millwright work for Ronnie Baim, there was a guy that he had. Who had had too many DUIs and couldn't drive anymore. So I was like basically his chauffeur because he knew how to do a lot of the jobs. So I became like I had to drive him around because he couldn't drive. But then I learned how to do all the stuff he did. His favorite treat on a Friday night, driving back from a job, is he'd get bugles in a thing of squirt cheese.
Squirt cheese.
In black olives. And he liked to fill that bugle up with squirt cheese, top it with a black olive, and eat it while he's going down the road. And you could imagine he had a drink accompaniment.
Yeah.
So, anyhow, my brother would wander around out in the woods, and I even have a picture of him. Like, he's, like, standing there with, like, all these bugles. But he'd always have a box of the bugles under his arm, and he'd be eating the bugles.
Eating one.
But then he'd, like, dump some of the box into the bait thing. But it finally becomes the first day, and he comes out there with a bucket to add to the bait pile, right? And he goes and dumps the bucket on the bait pile, and he's getting situated in his blind and realizes, shit, I left the bucket at the bait pile. So he says he spins to look, and there's already a bear standing there. And that was his bear.
Nice.
Just
nice.
Like very productive.
Yeah.
Did he top the pile off with squirt cheese and olives?
No, I don't know. That was a different guy's trick, but that would have brought in the big ones. But yeah, man, it was a whole other world, you know?
Yeah.
Living up here, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's you can get away from people and it's kinda nice. It's quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of wildlife, lots of good opportunities to get out. Even if you're not like into hunting and fishing, if you just you want to hike, Tequamenon Falls is right here, Pitcher Rocks. I mean, there's a lot of good seeing sights
to go and look at.
Yeah, and I did up here what would have been almost like unimaginable where we grew up hunting is as soon as I moved up here, I got two deer with my bow in one day, which would have taken 3 years. Which would have taken 3 years in some of the ground we used to hunt in, down below.
Yeah, the deer hunt's definitely not what it used to
be. No, yeah, that's what I understand.
From what I've heard.
Yeah.
But our wolf population's getting pretty big.
I remember cutting my first wolf track up here and being very surprised by it.
Yeah.
But now, yeah. But that in those days, it was like 35. What do they talk about? Like 35 deer per square mile and stuff, man. Just it was unbelievable. And the bad winter would come and they'd be like yarded up and starving to death everywhere. And it was wild.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got, obviously we ran all the bear baits and it wasn't uncommon that at least one of your baits every night had wolves on it.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And we got pictures like 3-4 wolves in one trail cam picture on your baits. And they'll rip them right open, move all the logs right out of the way. And
eat oh, really?
Bait. Oh, yeah. They'll run the bear right off.
Huh. That's interesting.
Sucks for us, but.
You don't do any fur trapping, do you?
I do not. the buddy of mine that owns the company, his name's John Ron.
What's his name?
John Ron.
Huh.
oddly enough.
Really?
Yeah.
See, that's like a weird thing. Like, it's not his fault, man. Yeah. It's a weird thing parents do now and then, They were probably thinking Jonathan Ron.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if his full name is longer. I know his dad is also John Ron.
Oh, really?
Oh.
So he's,
it's like Ron John Surf Shop, right?
He's a junior. But his company is Youper Outdoors 906, and he does his big things bears, but he actually takes trapping clients, and basically the clients will come in and trap with him and like run the line with him.
What?
And then they get to kind of see how it's done and like the ins and outs of it.
Because they're doing like a class.
They want to learn it or they want to experience it?
Both.
Or both. Hmm.
And then, so they kind of see how it's done, what to look for, how to do it. And then hopefully they get something and then, he'll take them, tan it and everything. And then they get to take the pelt back with them.
Really?
Yeah. So he's just kind of getting into that. And then he just got his captain's license. So he's starting next year. He's going to start doing, lake trout jigging on Lake Superior. And then, walleye trips as well.
Real go-getter.
Yeah, he's a really good dude.
When I took when I was in high school, you'll know this name because of where you're from. When I was in high school, I took a day of trapping lessons for $250 from Mark June. who, when fur prices plummeted, he became like a big deer guy, like a big whitetail guy. You know, started doing like whitetail products and all that. You know that name, Sean?
Yep.
Yeah. Day of trapping lessons.
I personally have never really done it, but I know it's been around here.
I was going to ask you if you're allowed, because back in the old days, you were allowed 2 river otters here per year, and you're only allowed 1 river otter per year in the southern part of the northern half of the southern part of the state.
Okay.
So it's cool because you could catch 2 up here.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still 2 or if it's down to 1, but.
Sean, I wanted to return to something.
Yep.
This is your second time on the show.
Second time.
The first time you were on the show, we were with your friend who blew his toes off.
Yep, we were with Danny Two-Toe Morrison.
Who blew his toes off in a layout blind.
Yep.
And what's funny about this is yesterday we were hunting in layout boats. And I at first
had
trying to figure out like where I wanted my shotgun to lay. Thought about your friend blowing his toes off.
Were you keenly aware of like all of a sudden I should not put my gun down?
Then I put it together that you would not only blow your toes off in a layout boat, but you would then sink.
Yep.
And so then I was like, oh, that's why one would never, ever
put
their barrel inside the boat. It'd be bad news.
Yeah, in 35 foot of water.
Yeah. Joined also by our very own. Sitting here, the first person to ever be on this show in Birkenstocks.
Rubber Birkenstocks.
Introduce yourself, Max.
My name is Max Barta, and I'm a camera guy.
Are those actual Birkenstocks?
Yeah. $40.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you tend to side with the, like, do you have a lot of conspiracy theories? Do you think are chemtrails and stuff like that?
No. No.
You just like them.
They're comfy.
Yeah, no, I like
them. They're like Crocs, but more fashionable.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, you should try them.
Listen, I like them. I'm not down on them. I think they're great.
Have you tried them before?
No, I never have. Oh, well, can I run? What size are you?
10.
Really? Can I put them on for a while today?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do it.
If I put them on and I start going right on, right on. You'll know it's working. You're longtime production partners with Sean.
Yep. It's been about, I think this is our 5th year.
Working together.
Sixth, yeah. Working together. So.
You know what you need to realize? One thing I like about Sean, and it makes me like about you, is how loyal Sean is.
Yeah.
Because we didn't know each other. But when we're trying to get Sean to come work for us, Sean was like, there's just only one way this will happen.
Yep.
And that it's Max comes too, to the point where he legitimately would have not come work for us.
Yeah. No, I thought
you owe his ass.
Yeah, I definitely do.
So I was either like, either Sean is the most loyal dude on the planet, or Max is the greatest dude on the planet.
TBD.
But either way, either way, it seems like a win, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, Sean and I have been working together, like we said, about for 6 years, and we found out right away what worked and what didn't, and we just stuck with it. So,
mm-hmm. And you guys have done a lot of the waterfowl work together, but also predator stuff.
Yeah, we've been chasing fur and feathers for a long time.
is that the main thing you guys work on though?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, part of like working with Max and me wanting to have Max come along is not a lot of people can handle the road time of traveling, chasing ducks. And like, we've been on the road for 2.5 weeks now.
Yeah.
There's not a whole lot of production people that like want to be on the road chasing ducks for 2.5 weeks.
I think they think they do.
Right.
Yeah.
Until it happens.
You guys ever get in big, huge fights?
Oh, there's arguments here and there.
Oh, give me like preview one for me. Oh,
man. I don't know.
Max broke my tailgate hitch.
Yeah, I did.
Did he holler at you?
No, you could tell he was pretty upset.
Yeah.
No, it was just like, frustrated. Yeah, it was just like, I didn't break that tailgate handle. You broke that tailgate handle.
No, I'm with you.
Yeah.
I think it broke itself.
Sean, lay out what we're working on here.
We're working on a new show called Duck Lore. We're in Michigan hunting ducks, hunting divers on the big water, and we're putting together a whole new waterfowl series.
And Sean's at the helm.
At the helm.
You get to see him every single time.
We're covering all kinds of different ducks, different places, really gathering the waterfowl experience across the whole range of places. Started in Texas. Now we're all the way up here in Michigan, which seems backwards for the migration.
Yeah, where'd you stop along the way?
North Dakota and Nebraska. So we're on trip 4.
Then you're going to head west from here.
Yep, yep.
Right. We're going to talk more. We'll talk more about that in a minute, but a couple updates. The House of Oddities, so the auction House of Oddities, we're on to Group 3 now. Well, when you're listening to this, we're on to Group 3. We're a couple days ahead of the schedule here. Because right now we got, how do you say Danielle's dog? I've always been calling it a Drot or something just for short.
Yeah. Droth. I'm the wrong guy to ask.
The dog's kicking ass on the auction house.
What's it sitting at?
It's sitting at like 5,800.
It's a good puppy.
But you know what? They have 4 pups. So the way it's going to work is the winning bidder works with the breeder to select which dog is bad, like whether they want to.
That's cool.
Yep.
Basically, the pick of the litter.
Yeah. Male, female. Well, pick of the litter from their perspective.
Yeah.
They get to pick.
Yeah.
Because there's 4 different dogs. So the breeder will work with you to find out what you want because someone might want a male, they want a female, whatever the hell.
Yep.
Anyways, Group 3 is now launched. We got a lot of cool friends. We have a signed Pittsburgh Steelers jersey from Steelers linebacker Joe Schobert. He donated his football jersey to the auction house and got a bunch of teammates to sign it.
That's pretty cool.
Including the quarterback,
Ben Roethlisberger, and TJ Watt, Joe Hayden. There's a bunch of good names on there.
Minkah Fitzpatrick, Chase Claywood, Devin Bush, Cam Hayward, Juju Smith-Schuster, Najee Harris. Anyways, all these fellas signed this jersey, and this signed jersey is up in Group 3. So all the signatures on it. We got a hand-forged carving knife donated by Cal, but made by Riley Kirkpatrick Forge in Sheridan, Oregon. Cal was supposed to use it for special occasions, but he according to Cal, he doesn't have enough special occasions. And it's more beautiful than something he should own. So it's going up on there. It's meant for carving large hunks of meat. There's this other thing that's kind of this crazy set of things. There's an artist, David Burgess. He made these mugs that have everybody's ugly ass mug on them. So there's a Cal mug, a Yanni mug. There's even like a Durkin mug as a naval captain. All the people's mugs are on the set of mugs. No one in the world has a set. This is like not a thing.
Right.
These are like one-offs. You can get the whole set of ugly mugs by Dave. Spencer now. Everybody knows that Spencer Newhart's big rock hound. Spencer, his wife, Shelby, took their shit Spencer's always finding out in the woods and made a custom petrified wood necklace, Montana moss agate hoop earrings, and a pair of Montana moss agate stud earrings, all being auctioned as a collection for that special someone in your life. We also have framed original art by one of my favorite wildlife artists, Jamie Carmody. She does like gore. You should go look on her. Phil, pull up her Instagram deal. It's unbelievable, her work. I was trying to get her. She didn't want him not being too happy with it, but I was trying to get her to have me a painting of wolves that have disemboweled a bison, but it's still standing, but they're eating the entrails.
That's a hard one to get right.
Came to me in a feverish dream. And she's been working on it, but wasn't happy with it. Either way, we have a painting of her of dogs baying up a mountain lion, which is cool. It's like, you just got to go look at it.
Yeah.
You got to go look at it. It's an incredible painting. We have another meat crafter knife. And as you know, these are like rare than hen's teeth now and sell for a bunch of money. Another meat crafter knife. And the main thing, here's the main draw. Everybody knows season 2 of Das Boot, which includes a boat that my the boat is my childhood mentor, John Gary, my childhood fishing mentor, John Gary, his boat, his 1973 Starcraft, which then became my family's boat and then became the DOS boat, season two boat. But we got rid of John Gary's old 25 horse Evinrude. And this boat has been paired with a Honda, a brand spickety new Honda 4-stroke 40. All kinds of add-ons, all kinds of customization. You can go sign up right now. Go to the Auction House of Oddities. You don't need to buy anything, but you can just sign up for free, and we're going to give that boat away. So that's John Gary slash my old fishing boat paired with a brand new 40 horse 4-stroke Honda. It's a sweet boat. Everything on it's like, it's old, but like redone. Get it for free. Get it for free.
Giveaway. Yep.
That's a giveaway.
That's sweet.
Let me give you some behind the scenes. What it does is it drives traffic to the Auction House of Oddities. We wanted to auction it off, and that would have been a high ticket item, but we thought it'd be like not fair to people that can't get in on the bidding because of like whatever financial constraints.
Mm-hmm.
This way you just go win the damn boat.
Yeah, that's
for nothing.
Sweet. To come back to her art. It's Jamie_wild art.
See, I knew everybody else does a wild. Everybody does an underscore. It's you look at what I'm talking about with those pictures of hunting dogs.
Yeah,
does.
They're pretty sweet.
It's unbelievable.
Pretty, yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. She's got one here with a mallard that I'm a fan of.
Yeah, it's unbelievable looking. She's cool. Piece of feedback. We had on Paul Lewis from FHF Gear, who is a retired police officer. And we were trying to do a segment with Paul like called Ask Cop. Because like weird stuff cops do. You could ask, like he's retired. He has got no skin in the game anymore. You could be like, why do you guys always, right?
Yeah.
Do whatever they do. So we were like asking Paul, why do you guys tend to all of a sudden decide to turn on your lights and squirt down the road and then turn them back off again? You know?
Yeah.
So it's a thing they do. Well, a cop from Cheyenne, Wyoming wrote in and he said, this is to quote him, I was shocked to hear Paul describe the use of light sirens to get back to the office. He recognizes that Paul was joking, perhaps, but this is a thing that he really wanted to, a myth that he wanted to dispel. He's a firefighter, Cheyenne, Wyoming. He's in the officer seat, meaning he's in control of the lights, sirens on the fire truck. He's very aware of public perception of this very activity, and it always bothers me. He calls it running emergent and then shutting off light sirens prior to making it on scene. He says uppercase never. So like a Trumpian use of uppercase, we would uppercase never use an emergent response to get back to the station, to get dinner, to get to the bathroom, or any other non-emergency. You could get fired for doing that. And not only it's an inherent danger to ourselves and the public. Here's what he says happens. Someone calls 911. Holy shit, bunch of smoke coming out of the neighbor's window.
Yep.
Okay. The first information you have is there's an emergency situation. You respond accordingly. Then it's often followed up by the dispatcher. Cooking incident under control. Shut the lights down. Or car crash. Okay. Emergency. Then it follows up. It's minor. You're still going, but it's not worth
all the lights,
all the pomp and circumstance. Right. Says that's why we trigger, turn the shit on. Information continues to feed in. It's determined that it's non-emergency. You shut it off, and that's why that's happening. This guy hates when this occurs.
Oh, you got to feel.
But then listen, it goes on. Because Paul from FHF has a response. Corinne arranged a response. So now we have a debate. Paul says, I would agree with him and that this is something that would not be looked at favorably by the public or administration. Certainly not something we'd stand for normally, and I was trying to add a little humor. It's something that we joke about but really not do. That said, I saw a bathroom emergency happen once in the middle of the night after leaving a standoff with a guy with a gun. 10 years ago, times have changed. But he does concede 99.9% of the time it's because of changing circumstances from the caller. Now, here's another interesting deal. When we're in talking about antelope hunting, and we have an antelope hunting episode up on Netflix right now, and in it we use a game bag.
Yep. That was a good episode.
Yeah, we use a game bag on a, like a, I can't remember if I put it on a tripod or a gun barrel. Mm-hmm. I think I put it on the barrel of my rifle and wave it in the wind to get an antelope's attention. Now, I always felt that the white mattered because, like, antelope are emblazoned with a big white panel on their flank. And it's not for camouflage. It's for
visibility.
Seeing each other out in wide open, you know, on wide open ground. But this guy ran into this this historic account. So there's a report on an expedition down the Zuni and Colorado rivers by Lorenzo Silgreaves in 1851. And the expedition had a naturalist assigned to the expedition named S.W. Woodhouse. He talks about what a pain in the ass it is to get within rifle range of antelope back in 1851. They see you coming and they book off. And these guys are, you know, shooting. At that point in time, these guys are shooting, you know, muzzle-loading rifles. But either way, can't get in. And he said the hunters would just tie a red handkerchief to a stick and creep through the grass holding the red handkerchief up on a stick. And he said that would inspire a lot of curiosity on the thing, or it even come near. So that a little bit undoes my whole white thing.
Yeah, why does it need to be red?
I think that he thinks a bloody antelope is coming.
Hmm.
And he's like, why is that antelope so drenched in blood?
Got into a fight.
Does he need help? No, I don't know. I think it's
or
just curiosity.
Or can they even see it?
What's that?
Can they see the difference? I don't know enough about antelope.
Can you see the difference between a red and a white?
Well, I mean, they could. Is it that much of a difference in it, through an antelope's eyes that it would be like, oh, I'm going to go there because it's red, not white, or white, not red?
Well, here's the deal. I thought the white because
it matches the natural.
Because it was like he's seeing, right? Now I believe, or maybe, I don't know, maybe this guy, I don't know what, enough about Francis Wharton and who's this other hoser? No, that's not him.
No.
Francis Wharton, that's his old, listen, you won't believe Francis Wharton. S.W. Woodhouse and Lorenzo Sitgraves, I don't know. They sound like trustworthy names to you, Phil?
If you can judge them by that. I think it's weird. Like, if, let's say the antelope saw his buddy all bloodied up.
I'm joking about the blood.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I don't think that he thinks it's a bloody antelope.
Okay.
I think it's just curiosity stuff.
Sure.
But what's funny is when you're reading historic stuff, these are the kind of names everybody has. Lorenzo Sitgreaves and S.W. Woodhouse sound like dudes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
From a 1851 expedition.
Yeah, you can hear those names in like a Ken Burns documentary.
Oh, yeah.
You're like, that sounds right.
Like, we would never be sitting here, and I would never be like, I'm sitting here with S.W. Woodhouse. Because yeah. You know he's dead already.
Right.
Can't come on the show.
Sitgreaves.
This next story is super interesting. I don't know how we never heard about this before. Some Canadian guy wrote in. Because we're always talking about stuff to do with bones and whatnot, you know?
Yeah.
Like making like truck shifters out of your own hip joint when you get your leg amputated. Well, this guy sends in about this dude named Francis Wharton, who also sounds like a guy who'd be dead for a while now. He was at Little Fort, British Columbia in the 50s and 60s. Missing all of his teeth. Couldn't eat meat anymore. He goes out and kills a deer. And then ends up eating the deer with the deer's own teeth. Made a pair of dentures out of the deer's teeth.
I'm curious
and ate the deer with those deer's teeth.
I'm curious how quick he made those dentures.
That's the part that I don't understand. That's where I smell a fish. I think he might have ate the next deer.
Right. Deer number two.
But I don't mean to take away because there's a photo of this guy. And when you look at him, he's kind of got his half smile.
Uh-huh.
He's got what you might call a shit-eating grin. And you can tell something's not quite right with his teeth. Right? Would you look and be like, there's something not quite right with his teeth?
It looks like someone took a file to him.
But listen, you can go to a museum and see the guy's damn teeth. He made a full upper denture out of a deer's teeth. The collections manager at the Museum of Healthcare in Kingston has the teeth on display. Filed them down, put them into a base of wood plastic and household cement. Wore them for 3 years. They described them as kind of loose, kind of dark and dirty. He must use a lot of Polydent. It's a great idea.
It's impressive.
I feel like eating meat with them had to have been kind of challenging because deer teeth aren't naturally, like deer don't eat meat.
Well, I know.
You know?
Yeah. And these are, to be clear, he had more than one deer's worth of teeth in there.
Yeah.
Because these are just the incisors. Right? He's got like a whole row of incisors. Look at the set of those dentures.
Pretty wild looking.
Yeah, you just kind of have to gnaw away at it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. I like hearing that there's a place called the Museum of Healthcare.
Is that something you, do you get, Steve, do you get like satisfaction in that sort of like, if you want to call it poetry, whatever, of him eating the deer meat with the deer's own teeth? Because to me, that just makes me roll my eyes a little bit.
Yeah, I like the poetry of it.
Okay.
There's something that speaks to you, like there's something kind of writerly that speaks to you, but then also, what's my, you know my favorite quote, right?
Brevity.
No. Skepticism.
That's right.
Skepticism is the chastity of the intellect. So when I hear it, I need to go to a skeptical place.
Uh-huh.
Which my skepticism drives my kid bananas. Because of everything he tells me. Because here's the thing with kids. They mess up every YouTube video they see.
Oh, yeah. I know.
It's like, I was watching a video about a guy whose name is like Mr. Money, and he always finds envelopes, and every envelope he finds has $1 million in it. And I'm like, well, hold on a minute, you know?
I'm going to need some more details.
At first, I'm only half listening anyway, so I hate hearing people describe YouTube videos to me. And then all of a sudden, he'll get to the end. I'm like, homie, what? You know? And then he gets pissed.
Yeah.
Like, you don't believe me? It's like, no. It's not that I don't believe you, buddy. I think you're messing up what the video is about.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it drives me nuts.
I need to find more envelopes.
Oh, yeah. No, it's like everything. Like, I don't like watching YouTube. And you might think it's because, like, trying to protect your kids from the world and all that.
Yeah.
It's because they mess up every YouTube video they see.
It makes me so worried to act, because I feel like I kind of grew up with the internet a little bit.
Yeah, you're like a product.
I was at that like perfect age range where I can kind of tell when something is like a scam or not real or like these pop-ups. Like, this is all I can just point it out. And I'm so scared of putting my kids on the internet because they're just going to be thrown into the deep end.
Yeah.
And have no idea what to do.
No, they have no idea.
Yeah.
Because he likes to hunt. So he'll be watching, hunting videos.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. Like, just the mana. So there's like settings you can use on YouTube for kids. You use that?
I should.
Well, it prevents like, oh, you might also like, you know, and then they go down a crazy ass
exactly,
rabbit hole,
yeah.
You know? Here's a good story a guy wrote in about.
Some adults could use that too.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You know what? There should be a setting you could go into if your friend's kind of a dumbass, you should be able to go in and do like a setting that he doesn't know about that protects him.
Turn off the algorithm.
That protects him from stuff he's not going to be able to apply skepticism to.
Yeah.
Like a little sliding bar of you can turn up or down how skeptical the person is.
Uh-huh.
And if your buddy's like not skeptical, You just go slide that bar way down, and it only serves them like very plausible fact check material.
There you go.
No foolproof. No more $1 million envelopes for Max.
Yep. Guy from Minnesota wrote in with a great trapping story from when he was 13. So he was an outdoor obsessed kid. He would trap mink, raccoons, beavers, all of a nearby river. And his old man, check this out. This is where you got to pay attention. His old man's a veterinarian. Apparently, I didn't know this, but it makes sense. Veterinarians have a carcass freezer for all the dead dogs and whatnot, dead cats and dogs, okay? And because when they got to euthanize a dog, they freeze it, and then it gets sent to the dog cremation place. Since they had the big freezer, he would store his trapped animals in there waiting to skin them or waiting to go. He would bring them in. Like, if he would sell them, he would sell some of his fur in the round, which is fur trapping term. Mm-hmm. He one time goes down to the fur buyer, and he's emptying all of his bags out, and out comes a miniature schnauzer in place of his raccoon.
Got the bag swapped.
Goes back home, and there is no raccoon in that freezer. So someone, he thinks someone to this day, has the cremains of their dog. But in fact, it's his raccoon.
Probably sitting above the fireplace.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Never got it right.
The fur buyer's face when that dog got dumped on the table.
Dog came rolling out.
That's a weird looking raccoon.
Here's another good thing that we found. Kryn drugged us up. You're talking about whether or not you should like not the morals of shooting collared deer. Mm-hmm. It's not a moral issue. The aesthetics of shooting a collared deer. Like I would have, and I've made this clear many occasions, I would have a very hard time. Not that I wouldn't be able to do it. I couldn't do it. Shoot a deer with a collar on it, whatever with a collar on it. Mm-hmm. Just to me, because it feels tainted by the hands of man.
Yep.
And it brings up the thing of why is a banded duck cool, to which I just like, I don't know. I agree that they're cool, but I can't explain it. I can't explain it. But a collared deer is not cool. But this guy got himself a doe, not only with the collar, but two ear tags, and got it mounted. Ear tags and collar and a little radio antenna sticking out of it. Oh, yeah, full on mounted on his wall.
I grew up near the USDA clinic in Ames, Iowa, and you know they've got whole pens of deer outside, ear tagged, and it looks like a runaway.
Yeah,
got through the fence.
Yep. Well, no, but it's got that collar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the collar's the extra.
So the guy that shot the collared whitetail doe was Roy Winnings of Illinois. He's got some hunting land in Moultrie County. And he watches doe tromping around on there for 4 years wearing a GPS tracking collar. Killed her in 2012. It appeared to him that her health was declining. She'd been tagged by the Southern Illinois University Carbondale near Shelbyville, 9 miles away from his land. Okay? So she made it 9 miles to his place. Turned out the doe was 7.5 years old. In 2009, so 3 years prior to her to him killing it, she had an annual home range size of 106 acres. That's pretty interesting.
Just does not seem that big.
No.
At all.
No. When you bump it, you think it's like gone.
Yeah. A square mile is 640 acres.
Yeah. When you bump her and you're like, oh, it's like they don't go far.
No, not at all.
But it's interesting that, but consider this too, though. She moved 9 miles.
Right.
So she's running like an annual home range of 106 acres, but at points of time, whatever was inspired to like
move
9 miles over the course of time.
Do you think the human handling could have been that too, though?
Possibly, but I don't think it's, if you look at like, I'm going to talk about this dude, Kevin Monteith, for a minute, who runs all these deer collaring projects in Wyoming, and they act real normal, and then they go do something weird. Hmm. And then they act real, you know.
Yeah.
Or I shouldn't say act normal. They're in a spot, And then now and then, for whatever reason, they strike off. We were having on the show an argument. Yeah, it was an argument. Jason Phelps from Phelps Game Calls. I've been laying out for him the emergent thinking that nutrition is more important to antler growth than genetics.
Yep.
Because Phelps is still like the old, like, oh, that area's got good genetics. That area doesn't have good genetics. And researchers are turning up that, like, nutrition, not only is it perhaps more important, but it's more controllable if you look at herd size and habitat quality. And we had Kevin Monteith on to explain some of his work a couple of years ago, but I want to recap a little bit of it because I'm having like a somewhat spirited email exchange between Phelps and Kevin Monteith from University of Wyoming in trying to convince Phelps of what we're saying. And I'm going to refer back to something that Monteith discussed when he was on the podcast a couple of years ago. They took whitetails from the Black Hills and from eastern South Dakota. So you have, go ahead.
They actually put them, that was at South Dakota State where
they moved
where
into.
I live. Yeah.
So they're taking whitetails from a piss poor genetics area, Black Hills. And they're taking whitetails from a good genetics area, eastern South Dakota.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And they're saying, okay, so supposedly they got this whole genetics thing, and they bring them into captivity and have them raise fawns under identical conditions. So here you have the good genetics deer, the bad genetics deer. You keep them separated, so you got the same males and females from the genetics area, but everybody's eating the same shit in the same place. Okay. Now, what they find when they do this, as they raise these fawns under identical conditions, the deer are radically different sizes as adults when they're brought there. Okay. But they're only bred within their respective regions of origins. Now, the male fawns made up for more than 70% of the difference in size that originated between the two regions. So already, just the first batch of fawns makes up 70% of the difference under similar circumstances. Right. The reason it didn't do it all the way is because the in utero effects of it still haven't been borne out, meaning a buck's potential is in some ways decided by the condition that the doe is in when she becomes pregnant. Like the in utero conditions, that thing will hit the ground with its fate already sealed based on as the condition of its mother as she lactated and the condition that the mother's in as she like developed the fetus. It goes on to talk about, well, some areas where you have different stuff. You could have, they got deer where they have, there's a doe that has a very good year and she puts off a total slob of a buck.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes 5 years for that buck to reach maturity. But what's going to happen in 5 years has already been determined by what happened in her belly. So she could have a bad year and put off a buck that will never develop into anything 5 years down the road. The next year could have a great year and put off a buck that will turn into a tanker in 5 years.
Yep.
But you're not seeing the results of that for such an enormously long time. They had a buck that was born in 2017 following a winter in which his mom nearly died of starvation. But she pulled through and raised both him and his sister. He bore the consequences of that experience, that prenatal experience. He bore it for the rest of his life. When he was a two-year-old, he had a tiny forky antlers that anyone would have said without question he was a yearling. As a three-year-old, he was the size of a small two-year-old. People would have looked and said, oh, he had bad genetics. Monty said it's crap. He had a mom that was barely surviving and did not have adequate nutrition to give him the silver spoon and instead passed on a negative maternal effect that this male will never be able to pull out of for his life. He goes on to bring up this thing. He will never be able to express his genetic potential. Meaning, genetically, he might have the potential to have big antlers, but he just can't and won't. It's called the cohort effect, wherein males born in some years on average have larger or smaller antlers than those born in other years, even if they are harvested at the same age and live in the same places. It comes down to what mom was able to do for them. Even more nuanced is each female within each year. Maybe mom raised twin... I'm reading Monty's own email right now. Maybe mom raised twins 1 year and paid the price for it and goes into the next year in poorer than average condition. She will have less to give than the mom right next to her that lost her fawns early the year before and carries a heap of fat. They are liable to produce males with different expressions of potential. And yep, there are also micro nuances in the ranges they inhabit and the quality of the resources they have access to. He goes on to say that this applies to horns, not just antlers. But it brings up an interesting thing that deer hunter will always talk about. They'll be like, it's a good antler growth year this year. Mm. Right? You always hear that.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. What you might be seeing is you might be seeing that 4 years ago was a great year.
Mild winter, good
was
crops.
A great year for does. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A great year for big, healthy, fat does that produced a batch of great bucks that are now coming into maturity. And you're seeing a great antler year as an expression of great times before. So now we need to, as we talk about this, we need to point out this difference. You wildlife student, you'll be able to track what I'm saying now. Antlers, of course, I had to explain to my kids every week. Antlers are a bony material that falls off every year. Like antlers and horns are different. Horns and animal carry, with the exception of the American pronghorn, horned animals carry their horns their entire life. So they're looking at a population of unhunted bighorn sheep in the Sierra Nevadas. They can explain over 80% of the variation in horn size of adult males just by knowing how fat the moms were in those ranges. Sean's got his hand up. Not his hand up, but his hand open, open in an expression of wonder.
It just makes me wonder, like, how new is all this knowledge? Because you've heard the genetics discussion for so long, but it seems like, you know, moms being healthy is like, with what Monteith's writing here, it seems that plays way so much more of a factor than genetics. Why has genetics always been the discussion?
I don't know, but here it's a great point, and it frustrates him. Because one of the things he gets at is, if you're interested in herd health and you accept that, and I think you should, according to what he's saying, you look and be like, why do big antlers matter? Right? They're cool, you know, whatever. They're cool to look at, cool to hang on a wall. You could look at, and if you take this work, like this work has implications. Mm-hmm. If it is this crazy genetic stuff, and he never denies that genetic, like it's a thing.
Yeah.
But it's a thing that we have no ability to influence or control. But he goes, we can absolutely control quality, not control. We can influence quality of habitat. We can influence herd size.
Yep.
And if you can say that, like, and you not say, you can, you show, demonstrate, prove that big antlers are a function of habitat quality, right?
Yep.
It winds up being a thing that we can talk about and work toward and measure.
Yep.
And like apply the logic to the landscape of how do we measure and demonstrate like a healthy herd of deer? What's too many?
Antler growth.
What is quality habitat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if over time you see that areas that traditionally were producing big bucks and they don't anymore. Is it that the genetics went to shit?
No.
Or is it that we've degraded the habitat?
Right.
Or we're not managing herd size effectively.
Do you think at some point those two go hand in hand over a long enough period of time? Like if a line of whitetails just were malnourished over enough years, wouldn't that kind of lower their genetic potential?
No, because it has to be heritable.
Okay.
And Monty talks a lot about, like, when you talk about genetics, you have to be talking about things that are heritable qualities.
Okay.
Remember we were talking with Cal. We're going to touch on this later. We're talking with Cal about people saying that you're driving with rattlesnakes. That when you kill rattlesnakes that rattle,
you're making them more dangerous.
You're making rattlesnakes more dangerous because you're only leaving the ones that don't rattle first. Heffelfinger wrote in about that. He goes, well, first you'd have to believe that its tendency to rattle or not is heritable. Meaning that its tendency to rattle is something that it inherits from its mother or father.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than its tendency to rattle is based on conditions. Time of year, air temperature, proximity of threat, right?
Yeah.
That, why do you think that it like got it from its dad rather than it has to do with what its physical circumstances are at the moment? So Monteith gets into this in this email chain we're having. He gets into this idea of people saying you shot out the genetics. It got overhunted. They shot all the big bucks, and now there's no big bucks genetics to go around. To this he says, quote, crap no. It's like, hell no. Shit no.
I've never heard of crap no.
Crap no?
It's a few other words that I've heard before, crap no.
Yeah. But,
well,
yeah.
That's a new one. Thing. He's using the university email deal here, man.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, he's in a, you gotta respectable. Understand, you got to understand his position, man. He's a respectable dude and knows what, you know.
I like it.
Yeah. He knows what he's doing. He explains that it takes such an extreme level of harvest intensity that is perfectly selective to achieve that. And he says it's something we will never achieve in the real world. He says bighorn sheep, again, a horned animal that has very selective pressure on small populations, is the one place you could perhaps achieve this. And he points to a paper by a guy named Lashar, which he attached, to be like, that's a thing you could potentially see. But in the antler world, quote, not stinking possible. Isn't going to happen. I want to recap again. Go ahead. Sean's got his hand up.
Sorry.
But not
I
really.
I want to like, not on the antlers, but on the rattlesnake thing. I mean, isn't that what adaptation is, though? Is eventual genetic change to you live or you die. And so, like, saying that rattlesnakes no longer rattling is just, like, a fluke and isn't, like, a genetic adaptation to the ones that rattle get killed and the ones that don't.
We're gonna cover it.
It has to happen.
We're going to answer all
that.
All right. Because when we get into Heffelfinger's thing about snakes, we're going to cover just how many rattlesnakes are out there, approximately how many are killed every year, the factors that lead a rattlesnake to rattle, the impacts of air temperature on rattling. It ain't going to happen.
I remember that. That was another Black Hills, South Dakota, like, original. That was back in...
That they're going to kill off all the rattling kind.
I remember hearing that on, I'm pretty sure it was NPR, South Dakota Public Radio, years ago, was a piece they did on...
Really?
That rattlesnakes in the Black Hills don't rattle anymore.
He also gets into the only really, like, industrialized killing of rattlesnakes at rattlesnake roundups, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, where really are snakes dying by humans? That it has nothing to do with rattling.
Yeah.
They're getting them out of denning locations. It's just not a thing. I'm telling you. We'll cover it. I want to get back to Monteith, though.
Yep.
He's an eloquent dude.
Oh, yeah.
Says, finally, all this comes back to what has become for me a bit of a long-term goal in my career relative to impact. And that is, I hope that someday, when an incredibly large male is harvested, rather than the response being, oh, look at those genetics, it is instead, that boy must have had a fat mom.
He's talking about humans here?
No.
Oh.
No. Big bucks. Yeah. Big bucks.
No, I like that.
He says, for one, this is a reality. For two, it importantly shifts our focus to something that matters and that we can influence. We will never be able to tip the scale in the unseen and imaginary world of genetics to grow bigger antlers. Tell that to all them deer farmers. That's a whole different world, though. But the scale we can tip is that of nutrition, both through considering herd density and habitat quality, all of which shifts our focus from what is on the head of the animal to what is on the ground. To make more headway in the world of conservation, that is where our heart and minds need to go. Think of that.
I like it.
Dude's good. Okay, ready, Sean?
Yep.
You can explain something? The two-tier Nebraska duck system. Now, someone might be sitting there at home thinking, why the hell would I care about Nebraska's, whatever that means, two-tier duck system? But I don't know, man.
It's a test plot, or it's a test, yeah, and they're doing it in South Dakota, too.
I don't think I like it. Explain it.
So, Nebraska and South Dakota are testing a tiered license system where you have a tier one, which is your normal federally set by flyway license, or by flyway bag limits. So you have, for example, in the central flyway with South Dakota and Nebraska, you get six ducks a day and a variety of like species have more stringent bag limits by species. So mallards, you can shoot 5 mallards a day in Nebraska, only 2 of which can be hens. Or you can only shoot 1 pintail. But Nebraska and South Dakota are testing a second bag limit tier or a different license that allows you to just shoot 3 ducks a day, but whatever you want them to be.
They're selling this as to get more people duck hunting.
Yeah. And my problem...
Are there really like a lot of ducks flying around that no one's hunting for?
And I have never... Exactly. And I've never met a person that's like, I would buy a duck hunting license, but I can't tell what a mallard hen is, so I'm not going to go.
That's what the thinking is, though. It's like, it's too hard to tell ducks apart. So just sell a little shitting license.
Right.
Where someone can just go kill whatever they want, count it up to 3, and that's one tier. The other tier is people that will learn what ducks are what.
Yeah. I just think access is such a bigger problem. Like, having a place to duck hunt, especially in Nebraska, which is like, not overflowing with public land opportunity. You know, a lot of Nebraska's waterfowl hunting is like the North Platte River bottom that's private, leased, you know, across the state, the whole way is leases across that whole river bottom. And so I just struggle with like, oh, there's all these guys in Nebraska or young kids in Nebraska that want to go duck hunting. But the thing holding them back is that they don't know what a pintail looks like versus if they had access to, you know.
What's the price difference between the two tags?
I think it's the same, but I'm not sure. I haven't found that.
Do you know anyone personally doing it?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, I don't either.
The thing that like makes me real reluctant on it is pintails and canvasbacks. I mean, in general, I guess they're going to be less harvest because there's less of them. But man, if someone's all of a sudden whacking 3 pintails a day, not a huge fan of that because they're struggling as it is.
Well, it's a 4-year plan, and they're going to be monitoring the difference of the harvest differences between the two tiers.
Right.
To see, they're probably looking for just that.
Yeah.
Right. Because these hosers, I don't want to call them hosers, these fellers, what tier? The tier two folks could go out. Yeah.
And whack three canvasbacks a day.
Hens.
Yeah. 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 Three hens a day. Three pintails a day.
Yeah. They could shoot three pintail hens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 3-day possession limit.
Right.
So they could come home from the 3-day trip
with nine pintail hens.
10 pintails.
And this is an anecdote, but one I'm pretty familiar with. Maybe some of the easiest decoying ducks are typically going to be like a hen pintail or hen mallard. Like when a hunt's going rough, the ducks that still end up decoying are the hen pintails and mallards.
The one that winds up just landing in the decoys all of a sudden?
Mm-hmm.
It is a pilot program. They just say it flat out. The idea behind this pilot program is to allow novice hunters who have not yet properly learned duck identification the opportunity to go waterfowl hunting without fear of breaking bag limit laws. They want to recruit new duck hunters.
I will say that, like, it is intimidating. If this does help some people like understand what it is they're shooting at first light, it's a good thing. Because when you've shot your one hen pintail 20 minutes, 10 minutes after legal light, and you're real cautious the rest of the morning.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can't exactly tell what you're looking at, you let a lot of ducks keep flying.
So they got kind of a... It's not frequently asked questions because it's like, it's this is more like questions they can imagine in the future becoming frequently asked questions. Mm-hmm. Can you switch tiers? Uh-uh. You sign a deal. Can't switch tiers. If you're under 16, can you do tier two? Yes. Does it affect goose hunting? It does not. Quote, geese are easier to identify than ducks. What will be the effects of tier two hunters on restricted harvested species? Tier two hunters will be asked to participate in a parts collection survey. So they got to send in the wings from the ducks they harvest. That's the interesting thing about ducks is like a wing tells you everything you need to know.
Yep.
To a trained eye, a wing gives you species, gender.
Yep.
You got to send in a wing. So they can monitor the species and sex of ducks harvested and determine how much of a difference in harvest there is between tier one and tier two hunters. Therein lies there's the rub.
Yep.
If they do that work and there's no discernible difference, then, right?
Yeah. I think in general, the tier two hunters, if I was like foreshadowing or forecasting this, they're just going to end up with like more early season ducks and more hens because inherently someone that doesn't hunt waterfowl and is testing it out is going to be like hunting those early season environments.
For sure.
So they're going to end up with probably more hens, more drab, you know, early season ducks.
Have you hunted up in, you've hunted in the north. Where you start hunting early and the ducks are so drab because they don't have their full fall plumage yet. Man, it's hard.
It's really
hard to identify ducks. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a whole nother point, but Canada gloves off on pintails.
Right.
They can shoot four a day.
And hen mallards too.
But because duck ID is so hard early in the year, you know, Canada's season opens September 1. Well, ducks are like right at the tail end of their, you know, they're just coming out of the nest, right?
Yeah.
And they've pretty much said like, we don't expect people to be able to identify hens and drakes that early.
Yeah.
So you can just shoot four pintails a day in Canada and doesn't matter sex. So I guess if I'm complaining about this ending up killing some extra hen pintails and hen mallards, I have to complain about that too.
Yep. Well, it warrants pointing out though that not like waterfowl, we should explain this to folks a little bit. Most wildlife, most all game animals are just administered within a state, right? Like each state runs their own program because a state, it's deer, kind of it's deer, right?
Yep.
And one state could like totally screw up its deer herd, and that doesn't necessarily immediately impact the neighboring state. Waterfowl does. So waterfowl is managed by the federal government and the state governments who work in collaboration to set limits and, right? Because you can't have one state totally screw the pooch on it.
Yep.
And then have it be that the next state suffers the consequences during the migration. But not only that, but we have international
treaties. Yep.
Like our ducks are managed at a state level. Our ducks are managed at a federal level, and they're managed in collaboration with Canada and Mexico.
Yep.
So no one's really like totally going it rogue.
No.
I don't want to be the kind of guy that just hates everything new. So I'm gonna back up. I'm gonna reserve judgment on the tier one, tier two thing until you see if there's like any kind of like crazy ass harvest difference.
Yeah. In South Dakota and Nebraska, there's like things that don't concern me quite as much. But if this was the case in Iowa or Wisconsin, where you can only shoot one canvasback and you get 90% of the migratory canvasback population stopping at pool 8, pool 9 on the Mississippi River.
Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
So like the Mississippi River is the big staging ground for canvasbacks in late October, early November. But if all of a sudden, like, everyone decided to do this, I think you'd have these guys that love shooting canvasbacks.
Oh, they'd manipulate it.
They'd manipulate it. And they'd go to a tier two license and be like, well, now I can shoot 3 canvasbacks a day.
That's a great point.
And that worries me.
Yeah, you know what? It's a good point. When I was living in Washington State, I know that we're not talking about Washington State, but let's say Washington State had this. When I was living in Washington State, on the coast, you would absolutely do it for pintails.
Right. Yep. Of course you would.
Because your duck hunt boils down to like around Thanksgiving, it's lights out for pintails.
Yep.
So I would just be like, oh yeah, I'm going tier two. So I can just go shoot 3
pintails a day.
Because that's all I'm hunting anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I'm out there busting my ass trying to get Drake pintails.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
A single one. Yeah.
To get a Drake pintail.
Yep.
Now I can go like, who gives a shit? I'm just going to do tier two.
There's locations and states that would have to be like exemptions where you just can't do it.
Therein lies the rub.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Michigan, the bluebills and the redheads. You know, our bluebills drop to 1 in November. And if you're hunting Lake Erie or Saginaw Bay in November, you have a ton of bluebills. So, I mean.
Yeah, you're passing on bluebills.
Yeah, exactly. So if you could buy a license and now you can shoot 3 instead of 1, I mean, there's guys that shoot a lot of bluebills that are going to get that license.
Coastal Texas, I think the same thing. Pintails and redheads down there. Like, those boys just pass on pintails and redheads.
Right.
Most of their hunts. Because they're already limited. Like, waiting for an extra species to show up, you know? We'll see.
Remember earlier when I said, hey, man, just you might not care about duck hunting, but you should still listen to this? It's because of how beautifully complex the regulatory structure.
So complex.
For wildlife is. We have a guy we had on the podcast long ago. He's a social scientist. And he's working on this thing where you find people who are opposed to hunting or suspicious of hunting, and then you walk them through certain arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Not arguments. You walk them through like certain realities, and then you ask them, how did you feel about what I just told you? Right? And they'll tell you like, oh yeah, you know, hearing that, I feel a little better about it. And they tested all these different things. They tested the food, right? They tested financial structures, so like conservation funding. Dude's name was Greg Blaskovich. He explains this whole thing. But try all these different arguments out, right? And you see what like makes people what changes their impression. One of the things that I want to sauce this up by telling you what doesn't. The thing that they found that's interesting that people are they're not buying it. Overpopulation.
They don't buy overpopulation of wildlife.
When you're like, if you don't hunt deer, we're going to be overrun by deer.
They don't buy it.
Yeah, but think about it too. Who's likely to be anti-hunting is people like from a more urban setting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It just isn't going to, like people from a, they're not from the ag community.
Right.
So when someone from an urban environment, you're like, oh yeah, we're going to be overrun by ducks.
Yeah.
They're probably like, what the, what are you
we're
talking
we're not
going to
be overrun
what
in Central
Park. What are you talking about? Yeah, I haven't seen a duck in 3 weeks. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, it doesn't.
Mm, that's fair.
You know, if you imagine like who probably is adversarial, it's like people with the urban sensibility. So when you lay out to them like overpopulation of wildlife, it's just not something they live with.
Right.
And they're like, this is not keeping me up at night.
Yeah, the snow geese are destroying the tundra. They're like, I've never seen a snow geese.
Yeah, right. it's hard for me to like, you know, I can't, it's just,
yeah,
I don't buy it or whatever the hell.
Mm-hmm.
But either way, explaining the regulatory structure, like how shit like what we're talking about right now is determined and goes on. They're like, you know, then people are like, oh yeah, that's cool. I can see that. Puts them at ease.
Mm-hmm.
Puts them at ease.
Well, especially waterfowl should and would, because laws with wildlife as a whole, it seems like it's taken to the next level with waterfowl. It's just that much more complex.
I have, through my career, like I've had a lot of exposure to, you know, people publishing, production worlds who like do not come from a nature background, do not come from a rural upbringing, do not grow up hunting. I have found time and again people being pleasantly surprised to hear that there are rules that govern the taking of game, where they thought that in their mind, they hadn't thought about it, but in their mind, it's just like, it must be that you just walk out in the woods
and shoot whatever
and just shoot shit.
Yeah.
And they're like, and you're like, oh no, check this one out. You know, and you'll tell them like, for instance, there is a, you know, your, the end of your muzzle, like the end of your barrel, there's a diameter. Okay. There's like a thickness. They tell you what's too thick and too thin.
Right. Yeah.
That's a rule.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but what the projectile is made out of is regulated.
Yep.
They're kind of like, no shit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, I'm just scratching the surface, bro. Every single aspect of it is regulated.
No, as someone who didn't grow up in this world, that is absolutely true. People just think it's bloodlust, antiquated bloodlust. I'd say that there's like a decent amount of people that think that's what hunting is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Damn straight. You don't think that, do you, Phil?
Of course not.
All right. One last thing I wanted to talk about. So now Sean's going to come on with regularity.
Yep.
To do duck segments, waterfowl segments.
Talk about ducks.
The kind of shit we're talking about right now. Come on. He's going to tell you something you don't already know.
Yep.
For the most of you. But as a teaser to titillate everybody, talk about the complexities that you have, right? Like you're traveling around hunting duck state.
Yep.
In a truck for the most part.
Yep.
Right, driving from pulling the boat, driving
pulling
from
a boat, driving all over.
Explain to folks some of the complexities of managing your kill, managing your take.
Yeah, it is so much more complicated once you get into like even moving a duck. For starters, has to be wing or head attached, depending on where you're at.
Moving it anywhere. Except its final resting place.
Resting place of like your home.
Yep.
So
not your camper trailer.
No. So there's no breasting out birds when you're on the road. And this is something that I've seen very neglected, I guess I would say, just in general with waterfowl hunters, that people don't really care about it or know about it till they get written a ticket for it, right?
They're realize that this is a thing. That it has to have a wing or a head naturally attached.
Yep.
Until you get to your house.
Yep. And they're content going somewhere and breasting out their birds, and they've probably done it dozens of times and driven home with, you know, no problem. But then it's the one time they, you know, run into a game warden that they all of a sudden they're aware of the, and see a lot of these water,
it's a federal offense.
Yep. And a lot of these waterfowl regulations are so stringent because of the market hunting days, because there was no rules around waterfowl in the market hunting days, that once the rules did come about, they were like really laid down the law,
mm-hmm.
really, really had to be serious and particular to stop the market hunting. And you actually had certain places that were like holdouts. The Illinois River Valley is notorious for, like, even when the bird treaties came about and market hunting was no more, they were like, screw it. We're going to keep doing.
They're reluctant to
way.
Get on board.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And eventually it had to just be like wardens and federal officers like pushed into the Illinois River Valley to finally put the kibosh on market hunting.
Yeah. Cause they were going to lose it all, man. I mean, mm-hmm. we were going to like lose ducks.
Yeah, it's amazing that we have, that we can even sit here and talk about shooting 3 canvasbacks a day, because there was a point where they were just on a string, you know, there was almost no canvasbacks.
Yeah.
Wood ducks as well. And giant Canada geese, you know, that's another whole nother story.
Yeah, it's crazy when you read Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac,
mm-hmm.
Which he was writing in the 1920s.
Yep.
His idea of what it means to see a goose,
yeah,
compared to now, like trying to get him off the golf green,
yeah,
so he can like finish out the round or whatever, mm-hmm. play golf. Just wildly different situation.
Yep,
and that was in Wisconsin,
right?
What it meant to see a Canada goose in Wisconsin,
which now is, you know, one of the better goose hunting states, and like they're everywhere.
Yeah. Also in Wisconsin, Doug Duren, talking about when being a kid and you saw a deer track, southwest Wisconsin, you saw a deer track, you ran home and told mom and dad.
It's so crazy.
Yeah.
So back on the like traveling with waterfowl. So you have to have them attached, the wing or head. But then in addition, you have to have the birds tagged. Which is another thing that like people are just so not aware of, is like your name, your address, your hunting license number, etc. This, you know, what the bird and sex is. All this information has to be like with the bird as you travel, and the birds have to be separatable.
Yeah, that's that's
so they can't be frozen altogether.
That's a rule I've violated 1,000 times in the field.
Yep.
Is that you're in a blind with a couple guys or in a boat with a couple guys, and you got a pile of ducks laying there.
Yep. And I am.
They're supposed to be, those birds are supposed to be like, that's mine, that's mine.
Yep.
Keep them on a string.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be that there's a pile of ducks in the boat.
Nope. And you have to, you know, I think that's been something that for a long time game wardens didn't bother with, didn't prosecute. It was one of those things that was a law that wasn't acted on,
mm-hmm.
was like when they show up to a boat, say, okay, you tell me whose birds are whose, right? But now it seems like it's kind of had almost a renaissance of sorts, or maybe people are just more aware of more cases of it across the country. But in general, party hunting is not allowed for waterfowl, period. Like, you have to claim what you shot or what you didn't. And it's hard because you have a flock of birds coming in and everyone's, you know, together shooting at these birds. Sometimes it can be hard to know, like, who shot that hen mallard. As a waterfowl hunter, you just have to be responsible of, like, acknowledging that's the law and making a conscious effort to be like, oh, I shot that duck. Like, that is going in my pile in this boat. Or, Max, I know you shot that duck, so you need to, like, claim that duck.
Take ownership of the duck.
Mm-hmm.
Not just throw it in the big master pile.
Right. And because, ultimately, if there's four hen mallards in the boat and two hunters, okay, yeah, there's, you know, two hen mallards a guy. It'd be nice if that was the law, right? If it was like a party hunting deal, but it's not. It is a, you cannot party hunt for waterfowl. So Max can't go shoot four hen mallards and give me two of them and be like, we're good. We're at our hen mallard limit. It's just not the case. You gotta keep it separated.
And if you're doing a lot of duck hunting, you got to keep eating ducks.
You got to eat a lot of duck. Boy, do we eat a lot of duck.
Because you can't, because possession limit.
Possession limit. And we...
You're cooking ducks right now.
Cooking. Got them in the crock pot right now. We eat duck every day.
We got to find a new chili recipe.
Yeah, we got to find a better chili recipe.
You guys are making duck chili right now?
Mm-hmm.
We've already had it two trips.
Yeah. Just put all that, just
go
legs.
Third.
Well, you know, you get the birds that are your nice pluckers, right? That you want to like keep the skin on and do up nice. But then you get the ones that like
got a shot up.
Yeah, there's just no saving them.
And those are chili ducks.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you got? Tell everybody what you got going on right now. I saw you caught up jalapenos.
Yeah, it's there's nothing fancy about that chili recipe, but it's good. There's jalapenos, onions, some chili packets, celery, green peppers.
Bunch of duck legs.
Yeah, bunch of legs.
Is goose in there too?
Mm-hmm. There's some goose in there.
And you cook it all down, pick the meat off, throw the bones out.
Yep. Then shred it, throw it all back in, veggies.
Crock pot.
Yep, crock pot chili. Pretty good after after a cold day on the water.
It's kind of like a what you got pot.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah, we're just here in the other night just to close out. He's not in the room right now, but one of our camera guys was talking about being at a remote shack in Alaska, and this guy had this rule that anyone that didn't clean their plate, that food went into a pot, and on Friday that was the meal.
Yep.
Just the scattered leftovers warmed up in a pot.
Very, wanted, very motivational for
he
his
wanted
kids.
Zero waste, man. Zero waste.
I want to try it for a while.
Yeah, what
like,
you got,
just
pot?
See really what that ends up tasting like.
All right, we're gonna go hunt.
Yeah, now we're gonna go try to shoot some redheads.
Now that it's totally daylight out.
Yeah.
It's all right.
Divers are a little different than your traditional puddle ducks.
All right. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. You ready to let me try those shoes on?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm putting right some Birks on. Here it is.
Let me know what you think.
I'm just squeezing there real quick. Right on.
Right, you got to walk around and take a couple laughs.
Right on.
Perfect.
Oh, last thing, too. Remember this. Check out Duck Lore. It'll be on Meat Eater on our YouTube channel. Meat Eater's YouTube channel. Check out Duck Lore. Subscribe. Do that. Subscribe to the YouTube channel so you get all of our shit delivered to your house. All right. Thanks, everybody.